Chapter 12. COVID-19 and the battle over business as usual. COVID-19 began its public life as a holiday news dump. While much of the world prepared to celebrate the new year on December 31st, 2019, officials in Wuhan, China, quietly confirmed rumors that had been swirling for weeks about a strange pneumonia spreading through the city. An unsettling pause and further information followed the announcement. Public health and infectious diseases experts knew the first days and weeks were crucial. They worried China would suppress needed information as the virus spread to other countries. The moment of collective relief arrived on January 11th when researchers at Shanghai's Public Health Clinical Center uploaded the virus's rough genetic sequence to open-access websites, including GenBank, maintained by the U.S. NIH as part of an international consortium of open databases, and virological.org. The news was announced to the English-speaking world by Edward Holmes, a virologist at the University of Sydney, whose team had been working with the Shanghai clinic. Within hours of Holmes's tweeting out the links, scientists around the world had sketched a family tree that identified the virus as a close relative of SARS, a fatal zoonotic coronavirus that caused outbreaks in mainland China, Hong Kong and Canada in 2003. Later that same day, China reported the new virus's first fatality. A 61-year-old Wuhan man had recently perished at a local hospital. This news did not disturb the general public. Another 2 months passed before the WHO declared the virus a pandemic, crashing global markets and triggering runs on basic supplies like toilet paper. The public health and research communities, however, did not have the luxury of waiting or trusting Donald Trump's January 20th promise that it's going to be just fine. With the confirmation of the new virus's close resemblance to SARS, experts understood the window for containment had almost certainly closed. They were operating on a code red basis weeks before the agency announced a global health emergency on January 30th and months before war footing became a pandemic cliché that spring. What does it mean to approach a microbe with a war mentality? Who is fighting whom exactly? In science fiction films depicting alien invasions of Earth, nations unite against the extraterrestrial enemy. If this scenario had a chance of coming to pass in the fight against COVID-19, our microbial Martian invader. Its nearest inspiration was the global scientific community leading the defense, which maintains an internationalist ethos and code that has not been fully extinguished by the pressures of politics and commerce. During the winter of 2019-2020, this ethos illuminated a collaborative and globally unified path forward, beginning with the Shanghai-Sydney Genome Collaboration. This path was always going to be fraught. In late February 2020, the Shanghai Institute that provided the virus's genetic sequence without state approval was shut down by Chinese authorities. But by then, enough data existed to provide the basis for a much broader collaborative program led by the Center for Structural Genomics of Infectious Diseases, a global consortium of research institutions that included the world's handful of particle accelerators that were capable of producing atomic-scale maps of the virus's proteins and enzymes. At sites in North America, Europe, and China, teams pooled their findings to produce in record time a detailed picture of the virus and how it attacks cells and reproduces. Like the Shanghai-Sydney collaboration, the teams posted their findings to open-access online repositories. This data formed a starting line in the effort to treat and contain the virus. Work that needed 2 months for SARS in 2003 this time took just 1 week, observed the editors of Nature. Further, work that would normally have taken months or possibly even years has been completed in weeks. If the frame of this viral scientific puzzle was built in record time, it was logical to stay on the path of cooperation and continue condensing the time frame for the development and testing of treatments and vaccines, which would in turn increase the time available to build out the infrastructure required to produce vaccines for billions of people. This was the working assumption at a 2-day conference convened by the WHO at its Geneva headquarters on February 11, 2020. Burdened by a sense of borrowed time, the attendees, leaders in public health policy and infectious disease research, sketched a crash R&D blueprint for a world upended by the virus and disease that they officially named SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19. The meeting unfolded in the open science spirit of the January collaborations. Specialists compiled a comprehensive summary of coronavirus research and proposed ways to accelerate the development, testing, and production of diagnostic kits, treatments, and vaccines. The WHO conference produced a document premised on the assumption that researchers would work together, maintaining open communication channels and common stores of knowledge. Pooling resources and findings would minimize duplication and accelerate discovery. They expected this to hold true at every stage, from basic research to the HWO-run global comparative trials that attendees prepared as the best way to assess the merits of eventual candidate treatments and vaccines. One topic not raised in the WHO expert planning document, intellectual property. If the worst came to pass, the experts operated on the premise that a model of cooperation would triumph. It did not occur to them that proprietary barriers would be permitted to obstruct research development or the manufacture of products on the scale that would be needed. They were naive to think this way, but they weren't alone. Even the most cynical veterans of the medicines, access, and open science movements felt that this time, in this pandemic, the obvious benefits of collaboration and sharing would override the dominant paradigm of proprietary science and monopoly medicine. The tantalizing glimpses of this alternative paradigm lingered as February turned to March. It found support from unexpected quarters. Anxious governments spoke of shared interests and global public goods. Drug companies pledged pre-competitive and no-profit approaches to development and pricing. In cases where actions belied these words, the industry looked oddly weak and devoid of its fighting spirit. When Gilead Sciences quietly tried to extend its monopoly on remdesivir in mid-March after the drug developed with federal funds showed promise as a treatment for severe COVID-19, public pressure forced the company to rescind the application. 2 days after Gilead's retreat, on March 25th, the Swiss drug giant Roche announced a similar surrender to public outrage in the Netherlands, where it had initially refused an emergency request by the Dutch government to share its proprietary ingredients and specifications for a COVID-19 test. When Israel announced plans to order generic versions of an Abbey Inc. HIV drug that showed promise in treating severe COVID-19, despite ongoing patent protections that limit its non-commercial distribution in that country, there was no talk of lawsuits or Special 301. AbbVie simply dropped its protest. Other cracks in the TRIPS regime appeared in Germany, Costa Rica, Canada, and Ecuador, each proclaiming the right to override patents to facilitate research and produce affordable treatments. When the Financial Times editorialized on March 27th that the world has an overwhelming interest in ensuring COVID-19 drugs and vaccines will be universally and cheaply available, the paper expressed what felt like a hardening conventional wisdom. This sense of possibility emboldened the forces working to extend the cooperative model. Grounding their efforts were plans, beginning in early March 2020, to remove intellectual property walls from the equation and create a model for public and private actors to collect science and associated intellectual property in a shared knowledge fund until the pandemic was over. The idea became real in late May with the launch of the WHO COVID-19 Technology Access Pool, or CTAP, hereafter the pool. The idea of open science is as old as science itself. Knowledge is published to be built upon by others, who in turn publish refinements and additions to the benefit of yet others. This endless process is the giant who shoulders Newton references in his famous line about what allowed him to see further. According to ancient and Enlightenment ideals, this process is for the benefit of mankind. It provided fame and glory, but never ownership. As a formal movement, open science dates to the first international science journals in the 17th century, which posed a challenge to those who would keep their discoveries secret or stored in a royal patent repository. As a philosophy defined in opposition to proprietary and otherwise walled-off knowledge, open science acknowledges the fundamentally transpersonal nature of knowledge, as understood by everyone, from Heraclitus to Ben Franklin to Francis Crick. Every discovery is built from prior discoveries, each of them parts of the great mental whole of society. Every invention resists the notion of a solitary origin or creator. The folly of trying to assign one is compounded by assigning fictive creators the powers of ownership and control. In the context of a pandemic, this folly rises to a crime not just against science, but humanity. Only one thing could deliver on the rhetoric about COVID-19 research as a global public good: a mechanism for pooling research, shearing it of intellectual property claims, and assisting poor nations with the technology required to apply that research to production. This was the vision of the pool visible behind scaffolding inside the WHO in early March 2020. Its supporters understood the stakes because behind the rhetoric about the world being in this together, the outlines of vaccine apartheid in utero were already visible. Wealthy countries had begun signing the first bulk purchase pre-orders for vaccines in development. These contracts, like the state research subsidies that enabled them, contained no stipulations on pooling or tech transfer to the rest of the world. The pool was the last best chance to arrest this worrying drift. Costa Rican President Carlos Alvarado Quesada took the lead in rallying support for the initiative. In his direct appeal to WHO member states, Quesada emphasized the pool was a temporary emergency measure. Participation would be voluntary. Companies and countries would place their research and related IP in an open-access innovation hub coordinated by the WHO and modeled on an existing HIV/AIDS medicines patent pool overseen by the UN. The WHO would ensure that the aggregated intellectual property was licensed broadly to qualified actors of all sizes to maximize production and ensure access. Even within this alternative paradigm, patent holders would be due royalties on their products. The arrangement would end with the pandemic, with all titles reverting to their owners. On May 15, 2020, 2 weeks before the pool was activated at a formal announcement in Geneva, Donald Trump held a press conference in the White House garden to announce Operation Warp Speed, a federal program to coordinate and subsidize private sector COVID-19 research and development with a focus on vaccines. After his opening remarks, Trump introduced the man who would oversee the operation, a bullet-headed Moroccan-born scientist and pharmaceutical executive named Moncef Slaoui. A scientist and drug industry executive, Slaoui has spent most of his career at the multinational pharma giant GlaxoSmithKline. Before accepting the invitation to manage Warp Speed, he was on the board at Moderna, the Cambridge, Massachusetts biotech company that would receive more than $2 billion of the operation's total budget of $20 billion dispersed by the NIH and the Pentagon's Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. As a condition of taking the job, Slaoui unburdened himself of $12 million of Moderna stock. 3 days later, his former colleagues would make headlines for selling millions worth of Moderna shares at a much higher price, following a press release designed to juice the company's valuation. The program's details and Slaoui's selection were bad omens for the pool. It institutionalized a law of the jungle that Trump first signaled in March by seeking to purchase the German biotech CureVac and acquire its rumored vaccine candidate as U.S. property. Operation Warp Speed extended that impulse and pressed a template for the coming wave of corporate vaccine nationalism. It was a model for rich countries to lock down redundant levels of domestic supply by lavishing chosen drug companies with subsidies and pre-orders without asking anything in return. No requirements to share technology or license widely. No transparency on production or pricing. On the eve of Trump's announcement, 140 political and civil society leaders published an open letter urging other nations to choose a different path. Instead of funding proprietary vaccines, a Moderna or AstraZeneca vaccine, they called for the development of a people's vaccine. This would be a vaccine defined not by the technology used or the company that owned the rights, but its status as a public good, manufactured transparently, as widely as possible, and sold at cost, non-exclusive to any government or corporation. Action must start urgently to massively build capacity worldwide to manufacture billions of vaccine doses, wrote the signatories, top signed by the South African president and serving chair of the African Union, Cyril Ramaphosa. Now is not the time to leave this massive and moral task to market forces. We cannot afford for monopolies, crude competition, and nearsighted nationalism to stand in the way. Only a people's vaccine, with equality and solidarity at its core, can protect all of humanity and get our society safely running again. This letter was addressed to the health minister scheduled to gather virtually later that week for the 2020 World Health Assembly. It did not mention the pool to be announced at the end of the month, but proposed a more radical measure. A mandatory knowledge pool administered by the WHO where technologies could be gathered and licensed, whether their owners consented or not. The letter's undertone of bitterness reflected the scars of what it called the painful lessons from a history of unequal access. This was a not-so-subtle reference to the last time the pharmaceutical industry was allowed to control publicly funded medicines during a pandemic, when it chose to let millions of people die, as a symbolic statement about the lengths it will go to protect its patent monopolies. The chance that the drug companies and their governments might yet embrace the vision behind a people's vaccine, if only out of self-interest, receded further during the writing of the consensus statement that opened the World Health Assembly on May 18, 2020. The convening resolution set the tone and guided the agenda of the two-day conference. The drafting of the first pandemic statement found health ministers split along a familiar north-south divide. the developing countries wrote a draft, anchored by the call for an open licensing regime and a condemnation of monopoly medicine that was also a call for global justice. All of it was stripped out on objections by the United States, England, and Switzerland. The gummy compromise text merely acknowledged the Doha reforms to TRIPS and tersely noted the existence of the voluntary UNAIDS patent pool. It ended with a perfunctory statement of support for universal, timely, and equitable access to COVID-19 technologies. This was too much for the leader of the U.S. delegation, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar. The former president of Eli Lilly declined to sign the formal resolution and instead delivered a video statement blaming the WHO for the pandemic and touting the recently announced Operation Warp Speed. For good measure, Azar posted a letter on HHS letterhead expressing his concern that the resolution contained implications that may negatively affect countries' abilities to incentivize new drug development. Azar encouraged developing countries and their handful of rich country allies to dispense with any fanciful ideas about pooling and engage with innovators to find mutually acceptable solutions that achieve increased access to affordable, safe, effective, and high-quality COVID-19 health products. Despite the theater of U.S. objections, the resolution contained the seed of a possible North-South pooling coalition. The call for universal, equitable access was endorsed by every country of the Africa Group and the European Union. Perhaps these countries would give meaning to the words by coming together in the pool that was about to open for business. Or perhaps another document in the news on May 18th would prove a more accurate omen for a vaccine race, taking on a shape that looked all too familiar. It was lunchtime in Geneva on the opening day of the assembly when the good news arrived. With global deaths from COVID-19 approaching 500,000, Moderna had posted a press release offering an anxious world a spring bud of hope. Among dozens of healthy subjects injected with the company's vaccine candidate, mRNA-1273, 8 randomly selected volunteers all showed neutralizing COVID-19 antibodies. The statement did not clear even the lowest scientific bar. The data set was small, preliminary, and partial. But at a time when good news was a precious commodity, this was good news. It also bode well, perhaps, for the trials of other vaccines, notably Moderna's German-U.S. mRNA rival, Pfizer-BioNTech. As Moderna basked in glowing press that afternoon, the company's science officer delivered a virtual presentation to the UBS Global Healthcare Conference, a major investor event. The talk was followed by a second press release announcing a $1.25 billion public offering of Moderna common stock. Morgan Stanley was running the book and ready for Reuters. As it had that morning, the company's second announcement touted mRNA-1273, but this time left out any mention of its senior partner, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the NIH body leading the trial. The first stories detailing scientific concerns over the skimpy Moderna trial data appeared a day later after the company's share price spiked nearly 30%. Moderna announced publication of its full Phase 1 interim report in the New England Journal of Medicine on July 14th. Hours after announcing its imminent listing on the elite NASDAQ 100 stock index, reserved for the most capitalized non-financial firms in the U.S. economy. Catching the pump near the top were the company's chief financial and medical officers, who between them dumped shares worth $30 million. It wasn't the first or the last time drug company executives benefited from a well-designed and timed press release. It did, however, unmask the forces beneath the rhetoric that would determine the rollout of the first vaccines. This illuminating flash drew mild rebukes from those who understood the importance of keeping the grubby reality at least partially obscured by rhetoric of global unity. In this volatile time, please practice good corporate hygiene, Securities and Exchange Commission Chair Jay Clayton politely reminded Moderna and other recipients of Operation Warp Speed funds. On the scale of corporate misdeeds, the Moderna sell-offs were small time, but during a pandemic, they served as a reminder that the private interests positioned to dominate the first wave of vaccine production were hardwired to maximize market control and profits and not to inoculate the world with the most effective vaccines as quickly as possible. On May 29th, as the floating alternative paradigm of pooling COVID-19 technologies became real with the launch of the CTAP, the WHO's Ethiopian director, Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, who opened the ceremony with a solidarity call to action that invited the world's drug companies and their home governments to join the effort. "This is a time when people must take priority," said Ghebreyesus. "Science is giving us solutions, but to make them work for everyone, we need solidarity. COVID-19 has highlighted the inequalities of our world, but it is also offering us an opportunity to build a fairer world, in which health is not a privilege for the few, but a common good. Of the 130 nations that pledged commitment to universal access at the World Health Assembly on May 18th, only 34 signed on to the pool. Only 3, Norway, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands, were high-income countries. In July, the European Parliament adopted a resolution paving the way for the creation of 2 new EU-wide public health agencies that contain strong language in support of compulsory licensing and the WHO CTAP, among other positions not reflected in the EU's actions internationally. Brazil was on the list, but not India, its old ally against monopoly medicine. It was a small and fractured alliance. Not a single drug company was present. The pool did have a small handful of individual supporters on the industry side. Speaking to a panel discussion following the WHO announcement, Greg Alton, former executive vice president at Gilead Sciences, described the pool as a moral imperative, as well as an opportunity to measure the benefits of open science models of innovation. This was also the view of longtime pharmaceutical executive Paul Fellner, the CEO of Revision Therapeutics, who served 9 years as head of global intellectual property for the Swiss pharma Novartis. Fellner emerged early in the pandemic as a rare industry voice for pooling. Privately, he waged a futile campaign to change the minds of his fellow executives. There is a suspicion by many in the industry that CTAP is just a ruse by civil society to undermine intellectual property, said Fellner. But that's not a useful frame in a crisis of this magnitude, where governments are the major investors and the goal is to aid rapid innovation and development. My belief that transparency and sharing speed development is based on 30 years' experience, helping companies prevent sharing and maintain intellectual property barriers. Patents, trade secrets, know-how, they're designed to slow down competitors. If you reverse this approach to facilitate sharing, it will have the opposite effect, the one you want during crises on this scale. This won't be the last viral pandemic. To illustrate the advantages of pooling and cross-fertilization, Fellner pointed to the vaccine race between Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech to develop the first mRNA vaccine. The Pfizer-BioNTech shot is based on similar mRNA technology as Moderna's vaccine, but they ended up with much more demanding storage and temperature requirements, he said. Framing the vaccine projects as a race was a mistake, because once you start a process, you can't deviate from it, any more than you can stop running a marathon to change clothes. Pfizer couldn't stop and rewind the work that led to the vaccine requiring sub-freezing storage. Perhaps if they had access to Moderna's data, we'd have 2 mRNA vaccines that could be stored in a normal freezer. Some prominent critics of the intellectual property regime, who thought the pool too weak, a reflection of the neutered state of the WHO under the sponsorship of private actors like Bill Gates. Proposing a voluntary and temporary suspension of intellectual property in this view only affirmed the legitimacy of an illegitimate system. This was championed by the South Center, a research organization led by Argentinian economist Carlos Correa, who rose to prominence during the TRIPS negotiations in Uruguay. Low- and medium-income countries should not settle for being mere recipients of vaccines, according to a South Center paper, but must become partners in their production. This will require an agency willing to back up its words with actions, including non-voluntary pooling mechanisms that can ensure that the required technologies and data are made available and manufactured on a large scale, distributed rapidly, equitably, and affordably in all countries. The center paper concluded, "The crisis is also an opportunity for WHO member countries to reinvent the organization, making it a stronger and more independent international public agency with the capacity and instruments to implement its resolutions and initiatives." The vision for the WHO harkens back to the mid-1970s surge of the G77 as a political project. It was in response to these ambitions that the drug companies initiated the building of TRIPS as a seawall. When the pandemic hit a quarter century later, the industry had full confidence the wall would hold, but was not quite so confident that it could completely ignore the challenge posted by the pool. On the evening before the pool's launch, the industry held an event to announce it had everything under control and that the world created by TRIPS was still the best of all possible worlds. On the night of May 28th, the International Federation of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers and Associations, IFPMA, preempted the pool launch scheduled for the following morning by live-streaming a panel Q&A from a black box studio in its Geneva headquarters. To maximize press interest, the event featured an unusually high-level panel of 5 senior executives, including the CEOs of AstraZeneca, GlaxoSmithKline, and Pfizer. Joining the moderator live in the studio is Thomas Queeney, the IFPMA's director and permanent representative in Geneva. Many of the 100-plus questions submitted by journalists concerned the pool. This was expected. Allowing the executives to share their views on why pooling was unnecessary was the entire point of the event. Four of the five executives began with feigned ignorance and surprise about the pool's existence. Only Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla, impatient with the act, broke ranks to dismiss the idea of pooling intellectual property as dangerous nonsense. In any event, Bourla argued it was not necessary. Echoing previous statements by his colleagues, he pointed to specific evidence of his industry's commitment to ensuring access and equity. The evidence provided by the executives was something called the ACT Accelerator. This initiative, they said, featured the partnership sought by the pool, bringing together industry, governments, and major foundations, notably the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and its subsidiaries, Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, and the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. Each executive, in turn, invoked support for the accelerator as proof of their humanity and dedication to ending the pandemic as quickly as possible. The accelerator's existence, stated Queeney, obviated the need for additional efforts and initiatives. The Gates Foundation plays a crucial role here, he said. We already have platforms. The industry is already doing all the right things. As the 75-minute event progressed, the industry's shared accelerator script began to sound less like a series of talking points than a violent and uncontrollable tick. Responding to a second question about intellectual property barriers, GlaxoSmithKline CEO Emma Walmsley emitted a stream of undigested Gatesian word salad. We're absolutely committed to this question of access and deeply welcome the formation of ACT Act, a multilateral organization with multiple stakeholders, organizations like the Gates Foundation and Gavi and others, where we actually look at these principles of access, and so clearly we're engaged in that as well. If the accelerator had not provided a go-to answer for every question concerning access, equity, and intellectual property, the stammering would have been much worse. Again, it was Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla who brought a refreshing honesty to the proceedings. During one of his odes to the accelerator, he interrupted himself to offer gratitude directly to the event's invisible sixth speaker. "I want to take the opportunity to emphasize the role that Bill Gates is playing," said Bourla. "This man is an inspiration for all."